K-Mud Podcast presents.
Good morning and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes, and I opened with Annie Humphrey. She's from the Ojibwe Nation, Edge of America, the title cut from one of her first CDs. And that was all the lyrics were by John Trudell, and then she put the music to it. And she's just an incredible singer. She's eccentric in her own way. When I think of her as a singer, it kind of reminds me of Julie Francella, who's kind of unique in her own way, too. And she wrote an excellent piece that I just have to share, because yesterday was St. Patrick's Day, and I always kind of laugh because, you know, St. Patrick, you know, you think of him as Irish, but he wasn't even from Ireland. He came to Ireland. And, you know, when you start looking at the real history, I have this great book called The Saints Before They Were Saints, the Irish Saints, and, you know, how they were all spiritual people that had nothing to do with Catholicism. And, of course, when the Catholic Church took over Ireland, just like they did in South America and all the other places, they made them saints, you know, to get people to, you know, come join them. And the Irish people, you know, they're just right above the gypsies, you know, when it comes to the, you know, that list in of the people of Europe, you know, they're at the very bottom, you know, even if you just had dark hair, or you were the Black Irish. And my stepfather, who was my stepfather for, you know, 40 years, was born in Ireland and raised in Ireland, you know, came to America, but, and he always went back, and he was from County Cork. And so I learned a lot about, you know, the history of Ireland. And so much is going back to their original roots now. A lot of the schools are teaching Gaelic, and they're trying to just take back what was taken from them. So I thought I'd share this with you, because she says every year St. Patrick's Day arrives with plastic shamrocks, green beer, bad accents, and that aggressively cheerful amnesia America loves so much. A whole history gets flattened into party supplies. Colonial famine becomes a pub crawl. Resistance becomes merchandise. So today, St. Patrick's Day, she wrote this yesterday, instead of the usual hoopla, I keep thinking about sinners. More specifically, I keep thinking about those Choctaw vampire hunters who thunder into the beginning of the film and immediately make the whole story feel larger, older, and smarter. They are only on screen for a short time, but they set the emotional tone in a way that lingers. Before the Duke joint, before the seduction, before the blood really starts to gush, they arrive with a warning. They know evil when they see it. They know what not to welcome in. And they know, with the bone-deep calm of people who have survived history, that sometimes a monster shows up wearing a familiar face. In the film, the Choctaw hunters are tracking the Irish immigrant vampire Remick before he reaches the Duke joint. There is nothing accidental about the way that scene lands. Three Choctaw men are chasing the injured Remick and corner him at a shack owned by a Ku Klux Klan couple. Then they do the decent thing anyway. They knock on the door and warn Joan and Bert that the man they are sheltering is not who he seems. Even while facing hostility, they offer one last warning before they leave, because they know exactly what is coming when darkness falls. Mississippi Choctaw participants and cultural consultants helped shape that scene and the film's use of Choctaw language and representation. And I have to say this too. I loved seeing my friend Nathaniel Arcand from the Plains Cree as Clayton. Nathaniel is a personal friend of mine, so there was something especially satisfying about watching him step into that kind of quiet authority. He barely has to raise his voice. He does not need a speech. He arrives carrying grief, intelligence, and the weight of the world the movie only lets us glimpse. That is why the scene is so powerful. The Choctaw show up with knowledge, urgency, and purpose. They know the rules. They know what Remick is. They know the danger of the invitation. I also love that sinners ground that moment in actual care. The people on screen are not just a generic blur of native anything. The Choctaw are specific people whose homelands are in what is now Mississippi and Alabama, and members of the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians were involved in Sinners as performers and cultural consultants, including Choctaw language work and the opening chant. You can feel that difference. The scene has texture because it has roots. And that matters because Hollywood is still so allergic to native specificity that even decent films often treat us like seasoning. A feather here, a warning there, maybe a little tragic dignity for atmosphere. But the Choctaw Hunters in Sinners are not atmosphere. They change the temperature of the film. They tell us in a matter of minutes that the South had Native people there, too, still living, still speaking, still knowing, still confronting evil in all its forms. And if I am being honest, once you show me Choctaw vampire hunters riding through Mississippi with that level of competence and that little fuss, I want an entire film about them. I want the backstory, the first hunt, the passed down knowledge, the arguments around a fire, the old warnings, the songs, the medicine, the discipline. I want it all. Part of what makes this scene hit so hard on St. Patrick's Day is the real history humming underneath it. In March of 1847, not long after the devastation of forced Indian removal from their homelands, Choctaw leaders and others raised money for starving Irish people during the, quote, potato famine. That gesture has never stopped mattering. It was an act of empathy from one people brutalized by colonial policy to another people brutalized by colonial policy. Hunger recognized hunger. Loss recognized loss. The gift was small in dollars and enormous in spirit, and despite their own trauma, they chose to act with compassion for another people thousands of miles away. And we should be honest about what the potato famine was. Yes, the potato blight devastated the crop, but the suffering that followed was made far worse by colonial brutality. Ireland was structured under British rule in a way that left poor Irish families dangerously vulnerable long before the blight hit. Land concentration, tenacity, extraction, and dependence had already narrowed how people could live. When the blight came, other food was still being produced and exported while people starved. British policy was shaped by laissez-faire thinking, inadequate relief, and a system that allowed mass eviction even in the middle of catastrophe. So no, this was not just a sad weather event with potatoes. It was a human disaster deepened by empire, by policy, by greed, and by the cold logic that property mattered more than poor Irish lives. That history makes Sinners more interesting because Remick is Irish, but the film never asks us to confuse Irishness with innocence. That is the brilliance of it. The Choctaw do not meet him as some abstract brother in oppression. They meet him as he is, a predator, a manipulator, a thing that feeds on other people's lives, art, and longing. In other words, he is not the spirit of Irish resistance. He is a corruption of it. He is what happens when suffering curdles into appetite. That is such a sharp, necessary distinction, especially right now when people are constantly trying to launder power through old wounds. Sinners understand something a lot of public discourse does not. Shared history does not require shared delusion. You can honor kinship and still know a fraud when he shows up at your door asking to be let in. Looking at you, Mark Wayne Mullen, and that's another whole story, but in Ojibwe, we call that level of greed and appetite the Wendigo, but I digress. That fine line keeps rattling around in my head. He is not who he seems. One of the Choctaw vampire hunters says this to the Ku Klux Klan couple. It works inside the movie, obviously, but it also reaches beyond the movie. St. Patrick's Day in the United States has become one of those holidays where history gets stripped for parts and sold back to people in bright green plastic. The harder truths disappear. Colonialism disappears. Hunger disappears. The way Irish people were exploited, brutalized, and pushed into suffering under British rule disappears. And then, magically, what remains is just people in their shamrock novelty hats. Sinners cuts against that shallowness. It gives us an Irish vampire who's not a symbol of the oppressed, but a warning about what happens when pain becomes license for greed. He wants entry. He wants access. He wants to feed. And the Choctaw recognize him immediately, not because the film hands them a lecture, but because the scene trusts Indigenous intelligence. That trust is rare enough on screen that I felt it in my chest. The movie even leaves room for one of the tastiest possibilities of all. That Remick may have encountered Choctaw power before, perhaps through music, ceremony, or some spiritual force he did not understand and thought he could exploit. The film never overexplains it, which is wise. It lets that mystery breathe. But the implication is irresistible. He has encountered a people whose traditions hold power, and instead of approaching that power with respect, he approaches it like a thief. Again, not resistance, oppression. So on St. Patrick's Day, I was not particularly interested in leprechaun capitalism or the annual river of green denial. I am thinking about the Choctaw gift to the Irish during the famine. I'm thinking about the Irish who remembered it. I'm thinking about sinners and the way Ryan Coogler tucked an entire political and spiritual thesis into one brief, unforgettable sequence. I am thinking about what it means for one people to recognize another across the machinery of empire. Today, the bond between the Choctaw Nation and Ireland is still celebrated. In 2017, a sculpture called Kindred Spirits was unveiled in Middleton, County Cork, Ireland, featuring 9 eagle feathers shaped like an open bowl, honoring the Choctaw gift. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, the Irish people returned the kindness by donating to Native American communities suffering disproportionately from the crisis. The relationship has grown into a lasting friendship rooted in compassion and mutual respect. So today, St. Patrick's Day, I'm honoring anything. If I am honoring anything, I am honoring Irish resistance. I am honoring the people who endured colonial brutality and still carried their strength and humanity forward. I'm honoring the Choctaw who recognized that suffering and reached across it with generosity, even after their own devastation. I'm honoring the kind of allyship that is forged in history, grief, and recognition. That, to me, is the deeper story beneath the holiday noise with shamrock covered everything. The resistance, the allyship, the wisdom.
Oh,
And that was Asani. They are an all-women's a cappella group from the Cree Nation in Canada. Well, the last couple of weeks I've told stories about, the sterilization of Native American women. And I have another one today. And you say, you've been telling the story. I can tell you I did a lot of stories on the boarding school. I didn't just do one and let the subject go, because it has such an impact, on the Native communities and the trauma that went from generation to generation. And I know women, Native women that were sterilized, I have friends, Neelak and Shar and Dar and their mother, and just a lot of women, Native women I know that were sterilized. And so I also remember when I had my first son in San Luis Obispo. It was 1969, and there was a young girl next to me, and she had she just had her third child. She was about 25 years old. And this OBGYN came in. He was smoking a cigarette. I wouldn't want that doctor touching me. But I remember he came up to her, and see how she's doing. He goes, you ought to think about it because, you're 25 and you've had three children, so your vagina is nothing but a plaything now. I almost rolled off my bed when I heard that doctor say that. And if he said that to a young white girl, I can't imagine how he treated, women of color. And so those kind of things always stay in my mind. So I thought I'd share this with you. It comes from Native News Online. Last year, in preparation for the United States' 250th anniversary on July 4th of 2026, President Donald Trump signed Executive Order 14253. The order directs federal agencies to remove what the administration calls, quote, disparaging or divisive signs, plaques, and markers from federal lands, including national parks and public monuments. The order has also been used to initiate an audit of exhibits at the Smithsonian Institution to ensure what officials describe as, quote, negative portrayals of American history are removed. In practice, this effort amounts to an attempt to reshape the nation's historical narrative, highlighting triumph while downplaying or ignoring painful truths such as genocide, land theft, and broken treaties. When it comes to American Indians and Alaska Natives, America carries many uncomfortable truths, including the history of American Indian boarding schools, where generations of Native children endured physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. So severe were these experiences that longtime Native American activist Leonard Peltier of the Turtle Mountain Ojibwe recently said his time in boarding school was worse than his nearly five decades of incarceration in federal prisons. Another uncomfortable truth is the record of U.S. government's practices from 1907 through the late 20th century that allowed some 10,000 of Native women to be subject to procedures that left them unable to bear children, often without their free, prior, and informed consent. Native News Online senior editor reporter Elise Wild wrote about this uncomfortable truth this past week, and which I shared with you last week here on Heart of the Earth. And Wild wrote about Dr. Connie Redbird Pickerton Uri, a Choctaw Cherokee, a Native physician who discovered an alarming number of hysterectomies performed on Native people at Indian Health Service facilities. In her own independent investigation, she reported as many as one in four Native American women had been sterilized without consent between 1960 and 1978. Pickerton Uri later left clinical practice and earned a law degree, becoming one of the first Native American women trained in both medicine and law. With expertise in both fields, she spoke to newspapers, medical associations, and legal groups, boldly declaring that the U.S. government was, quote, using the vehicle of health care as a tool of genocide. In 1975, Dr. Pickerton Uri persuaded U.S. Senator James Abrzak, a Democrat of South Dakota, to request a federal investigation by the Government Accountability Office, then known as the General Accounting Office. The GAO's review confirmed that the Indian Health Service had sterilized a significant number of Native American women. The study examined sterilization practices in four of IHS's 12 service areas over a four-year period from 1973 to 1976 and found that 3,406 Native women had been sterilized, including 3,001 of childbearing age. Wild also wrote about two women whose work led to New Mexico lawmakers last month passing a measure directing the state's Indian Affairs Department and the Commission on the Status of Women to investigate the history, scope, and ongoing impacts of forced and coerced sterilization of women of color by the IHS and other health care providers. The agencies are expected to submit their findings to the governor by the end of 2027. The history of forced sterilization of Native American women is messy and painful, but it should not be buried. Understanding this history is essential. There are good reasons why the truth is important. First, it honors the women whose bodies, lives, and futures were violated. For decades, they were silenced, disbelieved, and blamed. Recognizing their suffering is a necessary act of respect and justice. It gives survivors the language to name what was done to them and the chance to reclaim their narratives. Second, knowing the truth exposes the systems that enabled such abuse. The IHS, federal policies, and medical institutions all played a role in allowing these violations to occur. And learning about these failures reminds us that unchecked power disguised as care can lead to systematic harm. Third, confronting the past prevents its repetition. History teaches that when governments ignore accountability, vulnerable communities suffer. By documenting forced sterilizations and other abuses, the country strengthens the principles of informed consent, human rights, and ethical health care, values every American should defend. And finally, acknowledging these uncomfortable truths strengthens our democracy. A nation that celebrates liberty cannot erase the injustices committed against its first peoples. Truth is not optional. It is the foundation for justice, healing, and the future where history is neither sanitized nor forgotten. This is why measures like New Mexico's investigation matter. They represent small but meaningful steps toward accountability, and the country should pay attention. Americans can still be proud this 4th of July while confronting and understanding the ugly history of how Native Americans were treated. Pride in our country doesn't require blind worship. It grows from a commitment to democratic ideals and from people willing to make the nation live up to them, even while acknowledging its failures.
Yeah.
And that was a Lakota traditional woman's power song. And it was by Anila Helper from the Lakota Nation. Yes, I'm playing all women. It's Woman Herstory Month. And I'm going to talk to you about Ada Deer. And I remember meeting her. And she was a very elder woman. And I just was an awestruck when I was just in her presence, because Ada Beer, a towering figure in Native American advocacy and the first woman to serve the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Indian Affairs, made indelible marks throughout her life. And she was born on August 17th, 1935, and she passed on to the spirit world on August 15th of 2023. She was born in Kashina, Wisconsin. Deer's early years were spent in poverty on the Menominee Indian Reservation, where her upbringing instilled her a deep sense of purpose and a commitment to social justice. Deer's journey was marked by groundbreaking achievements and unwavering commitment to her community. She shattered barriers by becoming the first Menominee to earn an undergraduate degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and later in 1961, the first Native American to receive a Master of Social Work from the Columbia University School of Social Work. Her lifelong advocacy came to the forefront in the 1970s when her tireless efforts led to the passage of the Menominee Restoration Act of 1972, which restored federal recognition to the Menominee tribe. This historic achievement not only reinstated the tribe's sovereignty, but also paved the way for Deer to become the first woman to chair the Menominee tribe. Deer's political activism extended beyond tribal boundaries. She ran for Wisconsin Secretary of State in 1978 and 1982, and made history in 1992 as the first Native American woman in Wisconsin to run for U.S. Congress. In 1993, President Bill Clinton appointed her as Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of Interior, where she oversaw the BIA and played a pivotal role in shaping federal policy for over 550 fairly recognized tribes. And during her term in office, Deer advocated for tribal sovereignty and worked tirelessly to secure federal recognition for numerous Native American communities, including 226 Alaska Native villages and tribes in Michigan and California. Her advocacy earned her the respect and admiration of tribal leaders across the country. Quote, because of her fighting for our federal recognition, we benefit greatly because of the aid that comes to us as recognized tribes. Chief Mike Williams of the Akik Native community in Alaska told Native News Online, quote, she was a fighter for sovereignty. In our conversations, we always talked about the restoration process. She fought so hard to have the Menominee tribe, her tribe, restored to full federal recognition status. Deer's impact extended beyond politics. She forged a deep and enduring friendship with Gwen Carr, Intergovernmental Affairs at the White House, who fondly recalls Deer's unwavering support and belief in her abilities. Quote, she always believed in me a lot of times when I didn't believe in myself. She took that incredibly wonderful quality about her and applied it in many different places and in many different ways, Carr said. Quote, the Creator gave her many gifts, but the biggest one was her faith in the good and her ability to stand for what was right in the middle of what was wrong. Not lose her footing and not lose her vision, ever. In addition to her political and advocacy work, Deer served on the board of directors for the Native American Rights Fund, NARF, where she continued to fight for the rights of indigenous peoples. Quote, Ada Deer was a great leader. We represented her when she led the Menominee Tribal Restoration Movement back in the 1970s. She later served on our board of directors and became the board chairwoman. And of course, she later became the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs at the Department of the Interior, where she did great things for Native Americans, John Echohawk, Executive Director of NARF, said. As an educator and social worker, Dears was an influence to the next generation of Native American leaders. She taught classes at the University of Wisconsin, Madison School of Social Work, and served as the director of American Indian Studies Program, inspiring countless students to carry on her legacy of activism and advocacy. Dear's life was a testament to the power of resilience, determination, and unwavering faith in the pursuit of justice. Her legacy will continue to inspire generations of Native Americans and all those who strive for a more just and equitable society. Ada walked on while in hospice care in Fitchburg, Wisconsin on August 15th of 2023 at the age of 88.
Money coming to us to buy my car.
And that was The Man Killers. It's an all-woman's northern drum. It actually began here in Humboldt County. I'm going to share with you the story of Weopa, Agnes Ross, a Dakota woman who kept her people's story alive. And Agnes Weopa Ross was born along the banks of the Wakpa Iksan, the Big Sioux River, where the land remembers everything and the water carries the stories of those who came before. She was the daughter of John Allen and Ida Wakeman Allen, a Dakota family whose roots run deep in that place, a family that had survived the Dakota Homeland War of 1862 and rebuilt their lives along the river with quiet determination. They didn't talk about being Dakota as an idea. They lived it because it was woven into their very being, their language, their humor, their responsibilities, and their way of interacting with one another. Her Dakota name, Weopa, was explained best by her son, Alan C. Chuck Ross, who carried her story forward. To him, Weopa meant beautiful feather, not a decorative feather, but a feather that is spiritually good, carried with dignity, a sign of a woman who walks in a good way. He said the name fit her because she moved through the world with gentleness, strength, and a quiet spiritual authority that others recognized long before she ever held a title. Her name described her character as much as it described the feather itself. She grew up in a community that held each other close. Aunties, uncles, cousins, grandparents, everyone had a role and everyone helped raise the children. The river was her first teacher, steady and patient. Her parents were her first teachers, shaping her with the strength of people who had endured history and refused to be erased. She learned by watching, by listening, by absorbing the rhythms of a community that had rebuilt itself along the water's edge. From that riverbank upbringing, she carried a sense of purpose that guided her into education. She became the first in her family to attend college, a remarkable achievement for a Dakota woman in the early 20th century. When she graduated in 1931, she didn't leave her community behind. She brought her education home, treating it as a tool meant to strengthen her people rather than separate her from them. She stepped into the classroom as a Dakota bilingual teacher, one of the first of her kind. At a time when Native children were punished for speaking their language, she used Dakota as a bridge, a way to help children learn, remember, and feel proud of who they were. She taught with methods far ahead of her time. Music woven into lessons, hands-on activities that made learning come alive, approaches that honored the natural curiosity of children. Her creativity and bilingual skill soon led her into the pre-kindergarten teaching, where she shaped the earliest experiences of Native children with warmth, cultural grounding, and a deep understanding of how young minds grow. As federal programs like Title I in Indian education began to emerge, she was already there, helping shape how she would serve Native children. She understood that these programs could only succeed if they honored the community they were meant to help. She used Title I resources to support culturally grounded learning, to strengthen early childhood programs, and to ensure that Dakota families were included in decisions about their children's education. In Indian education, she became a quiet architect, influencing curriculum, mentoring younger Native educators, and helping build programs that reflected the community's values rather than federal assumptions. And during the 1960s, her work carried her west to the Oglala people on Pine Ridge, where she helped organize the first Oglala Sioux Conference on Indian Education. She worked alongside Oglala educators and leaders during a time when tribes were asserting more control over their own schools. And in 1968, she supported the creation of the first tribal college on Pine Ridge, helping lay the groundwork for what would become a national movement toward tribal higher education. Her work there strengthened the foundation of Indian education across the entire region. And no matter how far her work took her, the river always called her home. After her time with the Oglalas, she returned to Wakpa Ishikasan to the community that helped shape her and the land that had raised her. She returned not as a young teacher beginning her journey, but as a woman carrying decades of knowledge, educational, cultural, and spiritual, ready to pour it back into her own people. Along her work in education, she carried one of the most sacred responsibilities in Dakota culture. She was the keeper of the female medicine bundle. This role is recognized in a woman who carries depth, humility, and spiritual discipline. She guided families through healing, protected teachings that had survived war, removal, and suppression, and ensured that the spiritual life of her people remained intact. She held this responsibility with the same steadiness she brought to her classroom, quietly, faithfully, without seeking recognition. Her leadership extended beyond ceremony and education. She became the first woman chairperson of the Flando Santi Sioux tribe, stepping into political leadership with the calm authority of someone who understood both the old ways and the new systems pressing in on her people. She led with clarity, cultural grounding, and a long-view vision shaped by the teachings she had carried since childhood. Her decisions were made not for the moment, but for the generations coming after. Her impact was so profound that the tribe named its central educational institution after her, the Agnes Ross Education Center, a place where children learn, families gathered, and Dakota identity is honored. It stands as a testament to the life of a woman who believed that education should strengthen a people, not erase them. Her story was preserved in the biography Keeper of the Female Medicine Bundle, Biography of Wipopa, written by her son, Alan Charles Ross, ensuring that her teachings, her leadership, and her life would not be lost to time. He wrote not as a distant historian, but as a son who had watched her carry her name, beautiful feather, with the dignity and goodness it required. Everything she did, teaching, leading, healing, shaping programs like Title I and Indian education from the inside, working with the Oglalas and returning home, came from the same source. She belonged to a community that had survived, rebuilt, and carried itself forward with dignity. She knew the river that raised her. She knew the parents who shaped her. She knew the history her family had endured. She knew the language that carried her people through generations. And she made sure that Dakota children, those in her classroom, those served by the programs she helped shape, and those yet to be born, would know themselves too. She was a woman who preserved history, traditions, language, and the right of Dakota children to learn as Dakota people, not by holding these things tightly, but by passing them forward. A Dakota woman who carried the past into the future with grace, a woman whose life still ripples outward like the river that raised her. And I'm sharing these stories of women because you've probably never heard of them. But it's because of their resilience, their persistence, and the DNA of their ancestors that gave them the strength to move forward. Yes, horrible, horrible things happened. The boarding schools, the sterilization, today the missing and murdered. But when you have that strength, that inner strength, and we all have it, we all have that strength in us, but those who feel it know it. And sometimes it takes situations that you never expected to find yourself in to find that strength. And there are some absolutely ugly things going on in this world right now. But we have the perseverance and the strength to keep moving on. I'll be back next week. This is Jeanette Armstrong.
We are talking about a systematic and methodical method of genocide that today uses more subtle tools than it did 200 years ago. And systematic and methodical it is. Our people, and every day, everywhere they turn, are being told, you are not good enough. You are not valuable as a Native person. Your language, your culture, your history, your customs, your ceremonies, none of those things are valuable. Even the way you look is wrong. The way your skin color is wrong. The way you dress is wrong. The things you eat are wrong. And in order to be any kind of a human being, any kind of real person, you have to dress a certain way. You have to look a certain way. You even have to pitch your voice a certain pitch. Because if you look too Indian, if you look too Native, then there's something wrong with you. There's something really wrong with you that you are not going to be able to succeed to do anything. You'll never be any good at anything. You're ignorant, you're savage, you're primitive, and you always will be as long as you're Native. That's the subtle message. And sometimes it's more than subtle. Sometimes it's blatant in the legislative process, in the bureaucratic processes, in the instruments that they use in the schools. It's either you become like them, become white, non-native, or you're nothing. You may as well die. You may as well commit suicide, be a drunk or whatever. Because if you're anything else, then you're ignorant, you're savage, you're valueless. And the thing about that is that they have every way of telling you that. Every way of showing you that. Every way of making sure you understand that you know your place. That you can only succeed if you become like them. We are valuable. We're much more valuable and much more precious in what we have today than ever before, and that becomes more and more clear to me as I look at the world and I look at the systems and I look at the sickness there and I look at the healing that needs to be done. And the onus is on each one of us. The onus is not on someone else. We cannot say, well, who am I to do anything about it? I'm just one little person. I can't change the system. I can't do anything about it. Every one of us has that responsibility. Every one of us can take on that responsibility. Every one of us are responsible, whether we want to be or whether we don't want to be. Things happen through action or non-action.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.